May it please the court. Your honors, this case presents two issues. First, whether the district court reversibly erred by excluding Mr. De Leon's character evidence. Second, whether the district court reversibly erred by miscalculating the amount of restitution. I plan to say only a few words about issue one. The district court did reversibly err by excluding Mr. De Leon's character evidence regarding law-abidingness. This court has stated that standing alone, character evidence may create a reasonable doubt, and that character evidence and law-abidingness evidence is crucial where the defendant disputes that he acted with the illegal state of mind. Here, the district court confused Rule 404A2 and Rule 608A and restricted Mr. De Leon's character evidence only to reputation for truthfulness. The error was not harmless. Mr. De Leon adduced evidence supporting that he was not guilty, including that Ms. Aguirre, or Ms. Orozco, she had known by two different names, was part owner of the company, and that she was the main biller during the time of the acts, during most of the time of the acts in question. Also, that Mr. De Leon was not in the office much of the time because he was visiting doctors, and that United DME was required to rebill due to audit issues, which made it seem like it was billing for things that had not been delivered.
You know, the government put on a pretty strong case, it looked to me like, from the record. I mean, they had people in his office. They had former employees and people who had received the instruments that he sold. It's hard for me to see how the mother's bald statement that he's law-abiding would be very persuasive on a jury in light of all that evidence.
Well, Your Honor, there was also a second witness that he planned to tender that would have testified as to his law-abidingness. And you're right. We don't dispute that the government put on a number of witnesses from inside and outside of the office showing his guilt. However, Mr. De Leon, as I said, also adduced evidence contending that he did not act with the requisite state of mind. So the question really was for the jury. And the question of law-abidingness, as this court has said, is crucial when the defendant disputes a state of mind. Because Mr. De Leon asked the proper question, and this is maybe where the case turns, the burden is on the government to show that the evidence was harmless. And where this court has said that character evidence is crucial, we would contend, Your Honor, that the evidence is not harmless.
I understand.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the second issue, the district court clearly miscalculated the amount of restitution. This court has said that for restitution, the offense of conviction is temporally defined by the period specified in the indictment. Here, the government used sentencing exhibits 3A1 and 3B1 that went outside the time specified in the indictment. The indictment alleged dates at most from June 27, 2008 through April of 2010. The government's sentencing exhibits went from 2005 through 2011 for one, and 2007 through 2010. So the evidence that the court used to calculate restitution was clearly beyond the scope.
Was there a breakdown by years, how much the loss was?
Your Honor, I didn't see that. The exhibits I reviewed, as I recall, it was voluminous. It was like an Excel spreadsheet with a list of claims. And I went through the one that was like a list of claims from 2005 through 2011. And by my count, there were 25,843 claims. They're just line items.
Oh, man.
And by my count, and I can't claim to be, precisely correct, by my count, 8,929 claims out of 25,843 claims were within the time of the indictment. So in other words, by my count, 60% of the claims used by the court were outside the scope of the indictment. Another way to put it would be that the claims, only 40% of the claims should have been used. But I think it's clear that the court used evidence and calculated the restitution based outside the scope of the indictment. Other problems with the restitution, as I say in my brief, I'll review briefly. Somehow, David Villanueva, who testified at trial, is doing everything for Mr. De Leon and delivering power scooters instead of power wheelchairs, came up with $12,000 in restitution. So how Mr. De Leon could end up with $750,000 in restitution is puzzling. Second, the only calculation in the record, as I state in the brief, that one can discern is counsel's calculation as modified by the court, and the court came up with $300,000 more in restitution than that. And finally, the court acknowledged that most of the products that had been billed had been delivered. The court said at page 684 of the record, I will accept as true, this is a quote, I will accept as true that the majority of people, of customers, did receive their products. And under this court's precedent, the amount of products delivered that had to be delivered should have been deducted, and there was no deduction. I do want to mention one final problem. After the court said that, the court said, of course, the question is whether the products were delivered before billing or after billing. And that was an issue with regards to guilt or innocence, because if Mr. De Leon billed for the products, got the money, bought the products, and then delivered them, that's contrary to Medicare. You have to deliver the product first and then bill for it. So that would be illegal.
But were all these issues raised with the district court? No, did the defendant argue that he had delivered all these items or 80% of them?
He argued that he had delivered items. He had witnesses in the hallway, and he said, Your Honor, I have witnesses I want to put on. I have evidence. And that's when the court said, I will accept that Mr. De Leon delivered the majority of the items.
Okay.
So he did have the witnesses ready to testify, and the court said, I will accept that. With regard to the court being concerned with whether the products were delivered before or after, the reason I go into that, and it's a relatively minor point, is because if they were delivered after he billed for them, that would be a violation of law. But in terms of restitution, if the people got the products and Medicare would have had, or Medicaid would have had to have paid for the products anyway, then that cannot be part of the restitution. And I cite the EDET case and the Klein case in my brief for that.
Let me ask you a practical question. Assume, for the sake of argument, that we don't reverse your client's conviction, but that we agree that there are problems with the restitution. Mechanically, how would that best be handled? How would the court go about, how would we help the court to see how to go about calculating the restitution? Would this require a special master? Would it require an accountant? How would that be done?
Your Honor, I think the law is clear that the government has the burden to show the actual loss of the victims. And so it's not the court's responsibility, it's the government's responsibility. And Section 3663A specifically says that if calculating restitution is too complex or too burdensome, then the court can forego awarding restitution. So it's, you know, as opposed to a civil case, here the government has to show what the exact loss is. So I don't think a special master would be in order. Now, I can see how the court might, if it's within the Magistrates Act, ask the magistrate to hold an evidentiary hearing in which the government adduces evidence. I could see that if the parties agree to it or if agreement is not necessary. But I think
the district judge can have some broad latitude in estimating the loss, doesn't he? I mean, he doesn't have to get it down to the penny or to the dollar.
As I read this court's case law, it has to be the actual loss as opposed to the sentencing guidelines, which is why we're not challenging the guidelines, because guidelines can be estimate, intended loss. I mean, I think it has to be down to the penny. But even if not, it's got to be, you know, close.
Some reasonable basis for the award.
Yeah, surely the judge can get down below where it's not debatable that it's still up over whatever the loss is. In other words, I mean, if he's errs or she errs on downside and it's less, perhaps, it seems to me that that would be in the ballpark. I'm hard pressed to see how we or somebody would reverse a court by saying that it didn't come in on the penny, as opposed to the amount of money that would need to be generated with accountants, the delay, et cetera, having a multi-day hearing to try to figure out to the penny. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you wouldn't dispute that, would you?
Well, Your Honor, I guess it's two different issues. What has to happen in a district court and what this court would reverse?
Well,
and
the question was mechanically, assuming arguendo, you say it's too much, remand. Well, something has to happen below. And the question was mechanically, you correctly point out it's the government's burden. But if it goes down, they're not likely to throw their hands up and say, well, this is too complex, we'll forego restitution. So the question is, where are you? And so with all the discretion the district court has, to me at least, is conceivable, there is a level at which one can say it's at least this much, although it may be more, and opine it, as opposed to having a three-day hearing and all the money generated in order to determine the penny amount. And I'm just saying, would you say that be a reversible, that'd be an appealable issue on your side if the court didn't have the hearing but yet opined an amount?
Well, I guess my answer is two-pronged. First, the question is, what does the law technically require? And second, I think you're asking, what would happen on appeal? First, what the law technically requires, I stand by Sharma's statement that every dollar must be supported by record evidence. Whether that would stand up on appeal, whether the court would say it's no abuse of discretion, probably the court would if it found the amount to be reasonable and supported by the record. But at this point, I would say it's not supported by the record, and it's the government's burden to show it, and if under 3663A, if it can't show it, then the court shouldn't award restitution. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sokolow. All right. We'll hear from the government. Ms. O'Malley.
This restitution award has to go back, doesn't it?
Your Honor, no, it doesn't. There are a number of, I would say, confusing issues in the way this was calculated. However, if you go back to the record, it looks pretty clear that the judge did not include any of the claims prior to the charged conspiracy. I actually have the record cite for that. He ID'd it as going from 2008 to 2009, and that was on 654 of the record. He did include the claims that came in 2010, but the government would contend there that it would be a perverse incentive to allow a defendant to go out on bond and continue the same conspiracy that he had been charged with and then not include that in the restitution. So as far as the temporal scope goes, it would appear that he did not include anything prior to the conspiracy, but he did include the elements afterwards, and the government would contend that that was proper. The law.
I thought the figures that he used, though, were from the PSR, included these earlier years, the losses for the earlier years.
Actually, Your Honor, he worked specifically from the claims data, the raw data that came from Medicare and Medicaid. As Mr. Sokolow pointed out, it was an enormous file. It was so large it couldn't even be emailed. But the judge had the disks, I believe, at the first sentencing hearing. He had it for several months. And there are several points in the record where he explains the methodology that he used. And the methodology that he used is he took the three types of claims that had been proven at trial to be fraudulent in a general manner, that he had a standing order, and that were the delivery of the wheelchairs or the scooters rather than the wheelchairs, the charging for batteries that were never delivered, and the consistent under-delivery of supplies for diabetics and for incontinence. So he took those specific claims, and in fact, beginning, I believe, yes, Your Honor, beginning in the very first sentencing, called a sentencing, where they were just discussing methodology and determining whether this was going to be an issue or what was going to be an issue. Record 598 to 599, he advised counsel that that's where he believed they should be focusing, is on this data. And he asked the government, have you broken this out? And the government presented, I believe it was in that first hearing, first or second hearing, government's exhibit number one, where the losses were broken out by year. Now, that, of course, did not include, you know, it didn't break it down by month, which is relevant to the time period of the conspiracy, but it broke it down by year, and the government also proffered it, that, or actually entered into evidence, that raw data, which is what the judge manipulated in his chambers to come to the number that he came to, which he also advised was erring on the side of caution and to the benefit of the defendant. Now, there are various different ways, just working from government's exhibit number one, where if you take half the losses, say from 2008, and use all of the losses from there, where the loss comes to over a million, there are ways of going back in and determining just sort of a smaller portion of 2007 as well. And the government contends as well that while the indictment does state that the conspiracy was, I believe, from 2008 to March 2010, I believe, the government would argue that in this case, because it is the offense of conviction that determines restitution, and while that is defined to a great extent by the indictment, and clearly if it's a plea case such as Sharma, the indictment, the plea agreement are all you have to go on. But in this case, the evidence was the conspiracy began at least as early as when David Villanueva actually started working.
But the statute's clear, isn't it, that restitution is only owed for losses occasioned by the crime, the offense of conviction.
Yes, Your Honor. And the government argues here the offense of conviction is the full conspiracy, which goes back at least to Mr. Villanueva's beginning, because his testimony was that he'd never delivered a wheelchair, he delivered scooters.
I mean, the offense of conviction can't be anything other than what he's indicted for, can it?
Your Honor, in this case, the indictment came prior to the indictment included the co-defendant. And a lot of the information about how long this had been going on had not come to the government's attention at the time it was indicted.
Well, but I mean, if we got to look at the indictment to see what he's charged with, and that's what he's convicted of.
Yes, Your Honor. And he was charged with the scheme to defraud that involved a certain modus operandi, as the district court referred to it.
What about the complaint counsel opposite has on the judge didn't take account of the equipment that was delivered?
Your Honor,
the whole thing.
The government's position is that is completely without merit. In this case, there should be no offset because he did not deliver things that were medically necessary. The loss that was incurred by Medicare and Medicaid were for items he did not deliver. He did not deliver prescribed wheelchairs. He delivered scooters, which were not useful, were not usable, in fact, by the beneficiaries. He did not deliver 2 out of 3 months of diabetic supplies. He did not deliver incontinent supplies that would fit an adult. He sent child size and then billed for adult. So in this case, there is no offset for what he actually delivered because it was not usable by the beneficiaries.
And what about the way he divided it up between Medicare and Medicaid? What, he gave half for each one? How did he arrive at that?
Your Honor, I would say that that's just a matter of saying, well, the statute says that I can't ask him to pay over the amount, but as Your Honors have noted, to calculate this to the penny would be a huge burden. But it is correct. The government would, in fact, do that if that were required by this court. However, it would appear from the record that that is precisely what the district court did, that he took the time period of the conspiracy beginning in 2008. He did include the time period following the conspiracy, the 2010 charges, the fraudulent claims when he was out on bond. But other than that, he went back, he manipulated the data, he sorted the data, and pulled out the specific claims that had been brought forward in trial, which were the incontinent supplies, the diabetic supplies, and the delivery of scooters. So that is how he arrived at a number that was considerably lower than the affidavit. He did not accept the affidavit, so he did not move contrary to Sharma, even though he didn't have Sharma at that time to depend upon. He did not, the government contends, go beyond the scope of the conviction other than with the 2010 claims.
What is the what evidence does the court have that he continued to participate after he was out on bond?
Your Honor, that was brought forth in, and I don't remember the record sites for this, but this was in his second detention hearing. He was called in for violating bond, and the reason he was violating bond is because he had been admonished not to bill. And I believe that it came from Health Integrity, but it might at that point have been shifted over to the investigators. So there was the evidence that came out at the detention hearing, the second detention hearing when his bond was revoked, that he had continued billing, and that was verified by Medicaid and Medicare.
I'm still not understanding, at least the way I read it, it didn't appear to me that the district court was as precise in elucidating the basis for the restitution amount as you argue that the district court was. I mean, that's the first one, maybe did, but that, in just reading the briefs and going through what I did, it didn't strike me that, given what's here, that that's what happened. So I'm a little hard-pressed for how you stand on that proposition that it's good as is. But secondly, going back to the question Judge Davis asked you, it looked as if from 05 to 11 was the amount, at least the period that was in the PSR, whereas the indictment looked like it began June 08 to 2010 or something. So something about that, maybe I won't figure it out until later, but I don't understand, A, the basis of saying the award already has the crystal clarity to which, you know, you can say that it's good, and number two, the indictment begins at a period much later, so if the district court's opinion isn't clear as to how it went back these other dates, I just don't see how you get past remanding it with some kind of instructions or something. So help me understand.
Your Honor, I would agree that, in essence, the court didn't show its work. If I would direct your attention, though, to Record 633, where he starts talking about the types of procedures. This is in the first hearing. And where he is explaining to the defense how he thinks he should be rebutting the government's evidence, which is in the PSR. At that point, he was assuming that what was in the PSR was accurate. It's through the development, really, of the three sentencing hearings that I think the judge clearly articulates what method he's using. He definitely did not show it to the penny. Now, unfortunately, there is one thing that's not in the record that I wish was, and that's that the judge had put something up on the Elmo at the final sentencing that set forth, to some extent, what his calculations were. And, of course, that's not available to us.
Well, why should we affirm something that's not clear? Given the amount of restitution and the government's arguing for what it's arguing, even if that should be read, I mean, why should we scramble to figure out something that ought to be made crystal clear if it's sustainable based on what's there?
Your Honor, there's certainly no reason for you to scramble on this. All I can point you to is just that the court had the full data, and to sort of clarify the fact that the full data in the voluminous CD-ROMs is what was included in the PSR. That the judge rejected and said, okay, all of this can't count. He delivered some things. The conspiracy began in 2008, but he commonly overbilled certain items, he says on 667, 668. And at that point, he has invited defense several times to come in and rebut the specific evidence of the wheelchairs, of the diabetic supplies, the incontinent supplies. And at no point does the defense actually rebut it. They come in with a chart that has no foundation, to which the government does object, and which is based, in fact, not on what the losses were, but, in fact, on what he claims his profit was. And it's based, in fact, the whole foundation of it is that there was no fraud prior to 2009, which, of course, was completely contrary to the evidence at trial. So at this point, it was a winnowing down, I would say, from the total claims data, which is what the PSR included. The judge eventually decided that that was not a proper amount of restitution.
Were you the trial attorney?
No, sir, I was not. And invited defense to bring in evidence that, in fact, he delivered diabetic supplies, he delivered wheelchairs, he delivered things, and that that would be the offset from the total amount. And, in fact, defense never rebutted a single bit of it.
Can you just give us a quick summary of what the judge said in his best statement or series of statements explaining how he arrived at the figures he did?
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, let me grab my glasses.
Sure.
He says, it begins on record 686, 687. He says, based on the evidence before the court, which is voluminous, it is difficult, if not impossible, to ascertain with precision the actual loss. Therefore, I'm going to estimate it. I'm relying in part on what Defendant's Exhibit 1, which is a summary of information provided to the court this morning, we've been discussing, which reflects some historical information about profit ratios, cost of goods, sold ratios. I've also relied upon the exhibits that the government has tendered, 1 through 3, including 3A1 and 3B1. I believe 3A1 was the raw data from Medicare, 3B1 was the raw data from Medicaid. Prior to taking the bench, I've spent hours reviewing the spreadsheets, manipulating them in ways that I think makes them intelligible, and determining the amount of loss, those Excel spreadsheets. I can only estimate the amount of loss based on the evidence presented to the court at trial and then here in the sentencing hearing. The trial dealt with specific types of goods that were commonly overbilled and that were commonly involved in fraud by the defendant. It's judgment of the court based on preponderance of the evidence that a reasonable conservative estimate in this case is $750,000. Now, there are other record sites that I could also give you where he explains that that is the method he's going to use and invites both parties to use that method. And those come in both the first sentencing and the second sentencing hearings. Your Honor, if we have no further questions, I will be happy to address issue one if you have questions. Otherwise, I will rely on the brief for that. And I am happy to return the time to the court.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Soklow, you have a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. First, Chief Judge Stewart, I agree with you. I'm a little bit surprised, and maybe it's just me, but nowhere in the government's brief did I see an argument that the judge calculated restitution within the amount alleged in the indictment. This is the first time I heard this today. And I would have liked to have had a chance to brief it, but I just don't think the record supports it at all. Even with what counsel read, the judge said, I'm relying on Government Exhibit 3A1 and 3B1, which have claims that go from 2005 through 2011. So it's clear that the judge relied on claims outside in the indictment in calculating loss.
Couldn't the court mean that he's using those exhibits, but he's still limiting it to the period reflected within those exhibits.
Well, Your Honor, sure, the court could amend anything, but there's nothing in the record showing that the court limited the restitution to the time within the indictment. I mean, it's just not there. The government's evidence goes from 05 to 11. The court says, I went into chambers and manipulated these figures, and voila, here's what I came up with. And
maybe when we look at the figures, though, it'll make more sense.
Well, all I can say, Your Honor, is I tried. The best I could come up with was what counsel proposed that the court said would be a viable way of calculating restitution. I couldn't find it. If the court can find it, then the court will find it. Second of all, I'd like to point out that the government's argument that somehow you can use the evidence at trial is just contrary to this court's precedent. I mean, in Mason, this court said, and Judge Davis was on the panel, I believe it was Mason, that the scheme, restitution for purposes of the scheme, is limited to the temporal amount, the time alleged in the indictment. I mean, to say the court can go outside of that is just contrary to law. Finally, with regard to methodology, there is no methodology, except for what counsel proposed and the court modified with the calculation I came up in the footnote in my brief.
I don't know if you've read the restitution cases we've had in these child pornography cases like N. Ray Amy. I mean, if you read those, you'll see that the judge is given a lot of slack in estimating restitution.
Well, that's a different statute, Your Honor.
It's not that different.
Well, I mean, I don't think this panel, and I think you'll agree with me, can overturn this court's precedent. The precedent is it has to be the actual amount of loss. The government has the burden. It has to be the amount of loss that would have been awarded at a civil trial, and the government has to show that to the dollar. If some of the rule of law might be pertinent, then I guess the court can reconsider it en banc. But as we stand here today, that's my understanding of the law, Your Honor.
Sure, I've not seen a case saying a judge has to do it down to the actual dollar. I mean,
Sharma,
you know, even in a civil case, a judge can if he's got a basis, make a reasonable estimate of the damages.
Well, Your Honor, I stand by the quote I submitted to the court from Sharma, where the court said it has to be to the dollar. But even if it doesn't have to be, Your Honor, even if we say it can be within $1,000, $2,000, $300,000 is outside of the ballpark. I mean, I think we can agree to that. I don't think we have to today decide whether it has to be to the dollar, to the penny, to $1,000, $2,000. Clearly, it's outside of any calculation that you can glean from the record, and clearly the court used restitution outside the temporal scope of the indictment. For these reasons, Your Honor, we request that you reverse, and I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, both counsel.